Coming to you from Indianapolis, Indiana, the gaming capital of the world, it's episode 39 of Game On with Cody and John. On this episode's big deal, Event Horizon. We'll talk about event games, games that you set aside a whole day to play. And on this episode's Buy, Try, or Deny, Rune Wars. Will you battle for all of Terranoth, or will you flee from it? All this and much more on Game On with Cody and John. Well, howdy gamers. It is Game On with Cody and John. I'm Cody.
And I'm John. Welcome to the Uncommon Podcast for the Common Gamer. We're a podcast about all sorts of tabletop games, board games, card games, role-playing games. Hey, you name it, we cover it. Coming to you from beautiful Indianapolis, Indiana.
We are sick of winter.
Totally sick of winter.
Officially.
And I know we don't live in the Washington, D.C. area where they've gotten like feet and feet of snow, but we've gotten a lot more snow here in Indy than we normally do, and I am so tired of it.
Yeah.
I'm tired of looking out my window and seeing snow. I'm tired of scraping my car window off. I'm ready for spring.
Yeah, I always say that, you know, I could just live in Indianapolis my whole life. You know, I've been here my whole life thus far. I really like it, but man, about this time of year, I'm like, Florida's not so bad.
Not
it's warm.
Bad.
It rains a lot. I like it.
And I'm from Texas, where it never hardly ever snows. Of course, it snowed a bunch there this year as well. But that was one of the reasons why I moved here was, you know, I figured I love Texas, but the weather, I could kind of take it or leave it. It's too hot there. But I, you know, I was thinking 100 degrees. I could take it. Why not?
But luckily, we have a plethora of games to get us through these winter doldrums.
Indeed, yeah. If anything, it's a good time to sit inside and play some good games. So in our big deal segment, we're going to be talking today about event games. Now, I listened back to a couple of previous episodes, and I know that I've mentioned recently that I've not been into big, meaty games lately. I've been playing a lot of lighter stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we've definitely swung the pendulum in a different direction, and have started playing some bigger box, meatier, longer games. And so we're going to be talking about those games that take almost a whole day to play.
Yeah, that you have to set aside a special time and say, hey, we're playing Diplomacy. Hey, we're playing this. So.
Right. And so, and to that end, for our Buy, Try, Deny segment, what are we going to be looking at, Cody?
We're going to be looking at the new hotness from Fantasy Flight Games, Rune Wars, which is a big, meaty game.
Yes.
Set in their ever-popular world of Terranoth. So we're going to explore that and see if it's worth setting aside a day to play.
All right, but as always, we're going to start off with the Game On Inbox, which starts
now.
The Game On Inbox.
Send us an email at gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Do it. Well, it's the Game On Inbox, where we've got a lot of great stuff. We've got games we've played, listener emails, gaming news, all sorts of good stuff, but we're going to lead it off with a word from our sponsor, Myriad Games, and John's going to tell you a little bit about them.
That's right. Myriad Games sponsors Game On with Cody and John on behalf of all friendly professional game stores everywhere. They're a great friendly professional game store in Salem, New Hampshire, and also have kind of an online presence and some great podcasts as well called Myriad Games Presentations. You can check those out. And right now their website is under construction. They're really doing some great behind the scenes stuff to make it even better. But if you ever have any questions or want to get in touch with Dan at Myriad Games, because he's just a great guy for being able to have good game information. And if you want to place an order with him, I mean, seriously, it's like having a friend in the game business, really. But
it's your gaming concierge.
Yeah, that's right. But you can email them at myriad@myriadgames.com. You can find out about their MVP membership, which Cody and I have just signed on to do. Which will give lots of benefits and puppies and sunshine and chocolates and all that kind of stuff.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it's going to be good. So we'll tell you all about that as we participate in that program. So thanks to Myriad Games. We'll go ahead and continue on with the games we've been playing. Cody, what have you been playing?
Okay, a lot of this will probably overlap with John. So
we've been playing a lot of stuff together.
That's right, and that's always good. Mm-hmm. But I'll skip around. John and I we played our first game of War Machine against each other. I know the guys at the D6G are going to be really happy.
And they, as well they should be.
Yep. I've got my Kador battle box, and it's all assembled and painted up, and I played against John's Minoth forces, crushed them.
Yeah.
Crushed them. The glory of Kador was.
Yeah, let's move on.
Yes. we also played a three-player game with David.
Yeah, our buddy David from my job, yeah. And he's a Signar player.
Yep.
So we had the Signar, Kador, Menoth beat down there. Mm-hmm. And I was once again beat down.
Yeah.
It was a bad situation for me because I being a three-player game, we kind of tried to start at opposite ends of the board and sort of equidistant from one another. But I ended up sort of sandwiched in the middle where I'm going after the Signar forces while big lumbering Kador warjacks are tromping along behind me.
Yeah.
And it was just
it was tough to do a three-player game.
It was a Menoth sandwich. It was very bad.
But we played at one of the local game stores in our area, the Game Preserve that's not a Licorice Game Preserve.
That's right.
The one in the Fashion Mall near the Fashion Mall in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically played there to get the expertise of everyone, the regulars, if you will. And they were really helpful. They helped us with rules questions. They helped us with strategy without being that overbearing guy that like, well, why did you do that? You should have done, moved your guy up there. It was really refreshing. It was nice.
That's one of the things I worry about when we go to game stores is having that guy. And mm-hmm. then you're trying to play your game and maybe you've got some nice people there, but then you got that guy.
Yeah.
And you got to deal with him the entire night.
Yep.
And that guy did not show up at this game store. There was probably three or four people there that were actually playing some other games and were doing some other things, but they all played War Machine. And yeah, I was just really impressed with how friendly they were. So I mean, incentive to go back and to game with those guys again. So
absolutely
looking forward to it.
And War Machine has now kind of spread like a wildfire amongst my gaming group.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I've got at just top of my head, I know my wife's looking forward to trying it, and I've got two or three people from the group that have either bought their battle box or are in the process of doing so.
Yeah, so if we hadn't come across really nice folks at the local game store, we could just start our own league at this point.
Absolutely.
We've got so many people. So yeah, so miniature wargaming spreading into the game on world, so it's pretty cool.
Some other stuff I've been playing, I got to play the cult classic Lupin Louis last week. I love that game. I think I'm going to have to try and catch that the next kind of wave of imports that come in. And
I saw a copy of it online. I'll tell you about it later.
Very good. Some of the other things I played with John. Let's see, I did play it's kind of a cheap little game called Slide 5. It's just a quick little kind of card game. It's hard to describe. I don't know who makes it. I'm not as good as John is with those things. But
I want to say that... go ahead and talk. I'll look it up while we're talking.
It was just kind of this little trick-taking sort of game. And when it was brought out, I was a little skeptical. I'm like, that looks just like kind of like a dumb card game. Thing was just addictive as all get out. So do you have something over there?
This game, Slide 5, it's actually a bunch of different names,
mm-hmm.
Including...
I know it's got a real tacked-on thing about like snow skiers and
right. It's actually a rethemed version of a game called Six Nimit, which I don't know what Nimit means, but yeah, there's Category 5 and Six Nimit and Slide 5. It's all kind of the same thing. It's actually designed by Wolfgang Kramer, who's a pretty prominent Eurogame designer.
Oh,
so.
Well, I hated Slide 5. It was one of the worst games I've ever played.
I caught you.
You caught me.
Okay, well that's pretty cool. I'll have to check that one out. I've heard that's a really good little card game.
Yep. I'll let John speak to this a little bit. We actually got in a position where we got Twilight Imperium to the table and played through a few turns.
Mm-hmm.
That was something. And
if by a few you mean two.
Two. That's a few. And then I've been playing a lot of Dominion because at the upcoming HoosierCon, which we'll talk about a little later in the inbox, I'm in two Dominion tournaments. So I'm trying to
Keep
the mojo going, and I'm not doing great.
No.
I don't think I've won a match.
Are you still using that all-currency plan? Because you were a big proponent of the all-currency.
I do all-currency and whatever gets me... It's like all-currency and cards.
Okay.
And most of the... I'm only losing by like a few points, so I just need to like tweak a few things here. But
yeah,
I'm optimized. Getting there.
Okay.
But I find with sets of cards that have any attack cards, because we play with just 10 random in our house, that my strategy just goes to crap because mm-hmm. attack cards just throw me off and get me off that strategy. So
okay,
something to try. That's what I've been playing. John, what have you been playing?
Well, like you said, War Machine, been playing a little bit of that and having a great time. I was kind of worried that War Machine would be modeling is fun and the warjacks look really cool and then the game is kind of blah.
Mm-hmm.
The game is fantastic.
Yeah, it's really fun.
And it's really fun and it takes a little while to pick up and even now I was talking with David about our game and he said that it takes a little while to know what your specific pieces do and it's real easy to forget sometimes what bonuses your warjacks and your different troops have and so it's got a little bit of a learning curve but it's a really rich experience though. So enjoying that a great deal. I played a game of Chrononauts at work with a couple of friends, and it didn't go over real well.
No, that's too bad.
Yeah, and I like that game a lot, but the two folks that I played with said that it was a little bit too random for them, and they felt like it was too hard to get those patch cards that you needed. So
yeah, we Chrononauts is kind of I unleashed it on my group a few weeks ago, and they really liked it. But I think the sweet spot with that one is four and up. You know, I think like three-player games.
I think that is exactly the problem.
Yeah,
you're right.
Because, don't go real well.
Yeah, because when you have more artifacts on the table and more cards being played, more cards in the discard pile, then you have a lot more control over what's happening, yeah, which makes that game a little bit better.
Got to defend Looney, man.
Exactly. Yeah. And I've also been playing Dominion at work quite a bit, and that game is just spread like wildfire into the gaming community. So enjoying that one a great deal, and going to be also playing in that Dominion tournament at HoosierCon with Cody. So looking forward to that. Like Cody mentioned, we did set up this big event of Twilight Imperium 3rd Edition and played through a couple of turns. We'll probably mention this a little bit more in our big deal segment when we talk about event games, but it was really great that Cody's buddy Josh has played this game before. He brought the whole set with the Shattered Empires expansion also. And we played, literally, for the very first time, we decided to play a six-player game.
Yeah.
was that wise? Probably not. But that's what we did. And so we got everything set up and got a basic overview of the rules. And in, 4 hours?
4 hours.
We got through two turns.
Yeah, and that's with learning the rules and everything, but still.
Yeah. And after playing it, we all said that we liked it.
Yeah, it was fun.
That was interesting, and that we wanted to get it to the table where we could start at like 10 in the morning and, you know, just play through and you know, would be a lot smoother. But
that's what prompted our big deal idea.
Exactly, yeah. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I think overall it was a pretty good game. It's got a lot going on. So
Kind of a funny aside, Josh really likes Twilight Imperium and, you know, wants to play it more, and it's hard to find players. So every time we have an open gaming night, and this is, you know, just something, you know, where we'll start at like, you know, 7 at night and go till 10 or 11, you know, just a Friday night, you know, play a couple light games. He's like, I can bring Twilight Imperium. And it's like, I just don't think it's going to work, man.
I don't think we're going to get through it.
Yeah. But it's funny. He was real happy and did a great job teaching the rules. So big thanks to him.
Yeah. As a game teacher guy myself, as you know, I was very impressed with the way Josh did it, because I have a problem usually with spilling too much of the rules too quickly and inundating people with information. And Josh did a great job of, I think I have a lot to learn from him actually, as far as just revealing enough information to sort of get started and then taking questions as they come. So
you should get the game explainer micro badge.
Is there one?
I think there's like a teacher explainer one.
You have to loan me some geek gold.
I don't have that much.
Yeah, okay. Also, just as far as modeling goes, I've been getting some more stuff together for my Menoth army. So I've been finishing up painting my Holy Zealots. And just last night, I assembled my choir of Menoth and my vassal of Menoth.
Your Tom Vassal.
My Tom Menoth. Vassal of Menoth.
Yeah. Oh, praise Menoth.
That was a great impersonation of Tom Vassal. Well,
I love
done.
You, Tom.
And so I'll be getting those at least primed, and I figure once I get them primed, I can get them to the table. But it looks so much cooler when they're painted. And that's about it. Except, you know, I'm contemplating a carrying case for my miniatures.
Oh man!
As I've moved into this miniatures gaming thing, I need some way to transport them. And right now, my transport system is Tupperware containers and the models wrapped in paper towels. And it works, you know. I mean, I'm able to transport them. But
it looks more formidable than mine. I bring mine in my purple Looney Games bag.
I think that's very impressive.
You throw that on the table, be like, look at this.
It's pretty hot. But, I've been looking into, like, battle foam and some of these army transport bags. And, you know, they're expensive. I mean, for what you get, I mean, everything's relative, I guess. But it just seems like it's kind of expensive. So any advice that I could get from you listeners as to what would be some good carrying cases, if you've had experience with the battle foam or the army transport stuff, just send me an email at the Game On Inbox and let me know, because I want to make a purchase, but I don't want to over-purchase.
Yeah, I'm kind of waiting to see if we play more at game stores or play more of our home league, as it were.
Yeah, and that might make a difference too. So, all right, well, that's what I've been playing. You ready to move on to listener emails?
I am.
All right, let's do it. So we've got some emails. We got lots of great emails from you listeners regarding our game group episode. And it's so funny because when Cody and I sit down and come up with topics for the show, some of them are very well thought out. Some of them are just kind of like, well, let's just try talking about this. And then we just sort of, you know, do the topic. It just seems like the ones where we say, hey, let's just talk about this, end up generating the most interest. So, and that's great. Cause and obviously from reading these emails, game groups are really important to you guys. And so the first email that I want to read to you is from Magnus Lundgren.
I wish I had that name.
It's the best name.
If I was Magnus Jones, you think people would mess with me?
It's like, I would, but but I'm atypical. And he's written into us before. You might remember that back quite a few episodes ago, he talked about running a space alert tournament in his hometown. But he had an interesting piece of advice for us. He says, hi, guys. Always fun to listen to your show while hacking away here at work. In your latest show, you mentioned the problem with finding a game to play, you know, during a game group. I'm sure there's as many ways of solving this as there are gaming groups, and here is our standard non-patented way. Feel free to spread it if you feel like it. So we're not going to get any cease and desist letters over this. He says, we find all games on the shelves that match the number of players that we're looking for a game. These are marked by moving them out 5 centimeters. And he says, that's close to 2 inches for you Americans.
Hey, now.
Well, hey, we have a track record of being pretty bad at all things non-American. So thank you, Magnus. or, you know, 5 centimeters or so. Then we go around taking turns to remove only one game each by simply pushing it back in until we have only one game left. That is the game that is getting played. This mechanism has one huge benefit. No one needs to play a game they hate. It's actually fairly quick, even if you start with 100 games or so. And it makes for a fun metagame. Which games don't I have to remove because I know someone else will remove them, you know, so forth. Drawbacks, there's a tendency towards certain types of games, but I suspect that tendency is very dependent on the type of group that you have. And he says, keep up the good work. Regards, Magnus.
That's a great idea.
I think that's a really cool idea, yeah. He sort of reminds me of, like, jury selection in, you know, in America, the American legal system, yeah. You know, where you can just kind of... What do they call that? It's called... neither of us are lawyers, are we?
It's not vetting, is it?
No, it's a... there's some kind of legal term for it where you can make...
Have you ever been on jury duty?
No.
I have not either.
Okay. Once again, our expertise in...
Swing and a miss!
Our expertise shows. But I think it's a really good idea. So, Magnus, thanks for so much for letting us know that. And, you know, I have several bookshelves, so that would be really easy to do, to just pull things out 5 centimeters and do it that way.
Okay, our next email is from listener Brad Richards. And Brad Andy writes, I currently work in Tokyo, Japan. Cool. At an IT company. Having been a lifelong gamer, I asked around a bit at work to see if there were any interest. Almost all Japanese coworkers. Found out there were at least 2 who were interested, so I started a weekly game lunch where we eat a boxed lunch while playing a 1.5-hour game. It's a nice long lunch.
Very nice.
Also have a monthly game night where we play once a month on a Friday night. Attendance is not great, average about 3 people, but it has been a lot of fun and motivated me to continually add to my game collection, which is painfully expensive to do with shipping to Japan.
Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah. Where I really get my gaming fix is at the monthly Japan International Gamers Guild game day. We usually get 6-plus people and meet on the last Sunday of the month for several hours of gaming. Regards, Brad.
This is what I love about this, Brad, is that it's a group of 6-plus people. But you've got the greatest name ever, the Japan International Gamers Guild. I mean, it sounds like it's got like 5,000 people, you know. Yeah. But no, that's awesome. And, you know, and he says that average is about 3 people. Attendance is not great. The nice thing is, though, most games play for 3, mm-hmm. you know. And so you can always get something to the table. So I thought that was interesting that it's from get the kind of sort of international flavor.
Yeah. Thing.
Yeah. What is that?
That was a gong.
Okay. Moving on. We got an interesting email from Justin Nordstrom telling us a little bit about something that he's been doing with regards to our lovely sponsor, Myriad Games. I wanted to mention that. It says, hey, Cody and John, I meant to write you guys earlier to let you know that I contacted Dan at Myriad Games and started participating in the Game Swap program after hearing about it on episode 37. And this is like Myriad's thing where they do sort of like Netflix for games, mm-hmm. where you can rent games. It says, Dan has been wonderful and very supportive. The games show up promptly, nicely packaged, and so far they've all been brand new. I've gotten a chance to try them out and actually ended up saving some money this way, since a couple of them haven't been really my cup of tea. It says he lives in Pennsylvania, so I can't exchange the games in person in New Hampshire.
Live free or die.
He puts it in the email, live free or die.
Good man.
Yeah, but Dan is so responsive and shipping is so quick that it's the next best thing. I can't say this program is for everyone, but it's worked for me so far. Thanks to you two for suggesting it and for suggesting Myriad as a retailer. So Anyway, I said I thought the stuff about professional game stores was just hype, but Dan really knows his stuff.
There you go.
So that, you know, once again,
I'm surprised more game stores aren't kind of getting on that bandwagon. Not to like continually beat the drum, but I mean, you know, that seems like just such a no-brainer idea, you know, having a library and you know, charging kind of a nominal fee to check out games for a period of time. I don't know.
Now is the time. Game stores rise up.
That's right. I mean, we're going to try to rent a game, I think.
I think so, yeah. I think we're going to participate in that, and we'll let you know how it goes.
Yep.
You know, since we're on that topic, we want to also mention our game on seal of approval, which it's been a couple episodes since we rolled that out, and we are probably, I'm hoping next episode that we can have our first seal of approval. It's a little extra work on our part, so I'll be perfectly honest with you. It just takes a little bit extra time, and with other stuff, it's hard to get to, but we want to contact those best game stores and give them this seal of approval award, and, you know, stay tuned. That's going to be coming pretty soon. We've definitely got our first winner picked out.
Nice segue.
Was it?
That was nice.
Oh, thanks very much. All right, a couple of other random emails here. We've got an email from Ben Asaro, who says, "Hey guys, another great episode. I really like the transition from the Tanglefoot bag to the GM Academy."
Thank you.
And I think that's more in keeping in the spirit of your podcast, too. And he wanted to clarify something for me. He says, "Regarding Cranium Kadoo, which I talked about in the last episode, John, I think the word you were looking for was acetate." Dictionary.com says acetate is a sheet of clear plastic film fastened over the front of artwork for protection as an overlay or the like.
And so, now you know.
And knowing is half the battle. So yes, the little red piece of plastic called acetate. Thank you very much, Ben.
All right, and our last email is from Flip Flory. That's a great name.
Flip Flory.
Flip Flory, bringing you the hot tunes. From Bangor, Maine. Bangor, right?
Banger.
Banger.
I think it's Banger.
I can't get the simplest name.
My dad was born near Banger, Maine. He was born in, I believe, Mexico, Maine.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. So, hello there.
Flip from Bangor, Maine here. Yeah. Thanks for another good show. Just wanted to chime in with my two cents on forming a game group. I recently formed the Banger Area Gamers Guild, or BAG.
The BAG.
Badass Gamers Guild. While we were forming it, certain issues came up, like should we allow kids? Should we charge dues? What's going on? What's going into the charter? Should we have a charter? Tons of questions come up. I guess I'll just touch on a few of the major issues that I believe are the core of our group. And those are the questions that I was wondering that, you know, I wondered, is the Columbus Area group, do all these groups kind of go through this process? So here's how they went. John, why don't you lead us off?
All right. Number one that he listed was leadership. He says, somebody has to pick up the torch, and since we didn't have a gaming group, I decided it had to be me. If you're going to have leadership, you have to have a clear set of rules. Plus, finding people to volunteer for leadership is tough. It's like pulling teeth. So we decided to keep it simple. I'm the president, my friend Roger is the vice president, and my wife is the secretary. We hold these positions indefinitely.
The despots of Bangor, Maine.
the despots. Some might find this to be unfair, but we have written in our charter that if anyone wants to challenge a position and run for office, they can. The politics of the Game Guild in Maine. But with my experience in running nonprofit community groups, elections and trying to delegate committees just becomes unnecessary and just not fun.
Correct.
Yes. We want to keep it simple, and this seems the most effective way.
All right. His second point is about vision. He advises to have vision for your group. Our group's vision is simple. We want to provide a group where like-minded adult gamers can get together and have fun playing games. Living in Maine, you can feel isolated, and finding another like-minded adult gamer is tough. Plus, keep it simple, no politics, no pressure to volunteer or organize large cons. Great idea. Just come and game. This ties in well with our leadership model. Keep it simple in what the DM says, parenthetical, the president, is always right. I just wanted to use the word parenthetical.
Very nice.
After all, our hearts are in the right place and our hearts are in the right place and we just want to have a good time.
That's a very good point, and I think it's one that a lot of groups might miss out on, because I think the tendency is when you get a group of people together is, let's have a convention, you know?
Yeah, let's get bigger and more complicated, you know?
It's right.
Like you never really reach the promised land, where in this case, the promised land is just get together, have fun, play games.
Yeah, I guess keeping that vision is the most important, because you can keep coming back to it.
Speaking of.
Number three, keep your eyes. Look at this. Number three, keep your eyes on your vision. It's easy for a group to get hijacked or evolve into something else. Early on, I was barraged by requests for people to bring their kids to the group. Dun, dun, dun. Our high council had a meeting.
Oh, my.
Now it's the high council. And we decided no kids. It was a tough decision to make, but in the spirit of the group, the spirit of the group is for adult gamers to get together and relax and play games. If kids show up, parents have to keep an eye on them while they run around, or people would end up playing Hey, That's My Fish when they really wanted to break out Pandemic. It just didn't jive with the spirit of what we wanted for our group. We like kids, no problem if properly seasoned, but it was a possible recipe for disaster. That's I mean, that was a tough decision to make, and you know, when I'm thinking about a game group, that's a really tricky one for me because finding a babysitter is a challenge. But
I think they went with the right choice. Of course, I have no kids, so it's very easy for me to say.
Go ahead and the number four.
All right. Most importantly, have fun and don't take yourself too seriously. This is the core of any gaming group, and you got to keep that in mind even when making the big decisions. We're all here for the same reason. Not to say that tough calls won't come up, they will, but weigh it against your vision and which answer will result in the most fun for the group. And as far as don't take yourself too seriously, it actually says in our bylaws that any ties, an election, or vote will be settled with the roll of a D20. Good man. How would you like to see a contested election be settled like that?
Bush Gore, roll the D20.
Anyway, I could blather on and on about this subject, but I thought I would just try to give you some helpful insights. Hope it helped. Keep up the good work. Flip. He's a Game Knight of Maine.
It's Game Knight of Maine, yes. Community Service Games is how we play. That's what his signature says.
Very good email.
Flip, thank you so much for all that great information, and that really touches on a lot of what we were saying about the gaming groups, and I think those are great things to live by there. So with that, we'll close the Game On Inbox listener email portion here.
Sure.
We also had a lot of great responses on our Board Game Geek Guild. So if you go to the thread about the previous episode, episode 38, a lot of folks kind of chimed in about how they got their game group started. So go and check that out. All right. So moving on to gaming news.
That's just Dan from the Bulletin.
Why don't you start us off with gaming news?
Sure. First off is a bit of local news. We have... a local con. We did an episode from an event called Hoosier Con last year.
Yes.
It's coming here. It's that time of year again. It's going to be, I believe, March 12th through the 14th.
That is correct.
All right. At the...
It's a Holiday Inn, Indianapolis North.
At the Pyramids.
At the Pyramids, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Woo!
But, don't listen to us. Go to HoosierCon.com.
Right. Go to HoosierCon.com. That's...
WHOSYERCON.com.
Yeah, we know it's weird. Just go there. Check it out. It's a free gaming convention.
Free.
And yes, they don't trick you. It is free. Mm-hmm. They have a great kind of a deal with the hotel where that, you know, pays for a lot of the just the rigors of running the convention. They take donations as well. Mm-hmm. They've got a room rate if you want to get in on their hotel block there. They've got some good stuff there.
That's right.
But we're not going to be doing a dedicated episode there. We're just going to be going and gaming and maybe doing small pickup interviews with games we play. But just
we'll bring the recorder and might talk to a couple of folks. But
If you live in the Indianapolis area or just around Indiana, we would highly encourage you to come to the con. If you're planning on coming, there's actually a thread in our guild that's 576 on Board Game Geek that you can post in and let us know that you're coming, because we love meeting listeners. We love playing games. So come to HoosierCon and play games with us.
Yeah, we may even wear our goofy Game On shirts one day, sure. Just so you guys will be able to find us. So.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be great. So come to HoosierCon if you live in the area.
All right, next up in gaming news, this was big. When I found out about this, I wanted to move north to Minnesota, which has a lot more snow.
Yes.
The Fantasy Flight Event Center has opened, and I believe this is just down the road from their main offices up in wherever, Minnesota.
Roseville, Minnesota.
Yeah, there too. And this is fantastic. I mean, if there was one here, I would be there all week. It's basically this large kind of open gaming area with a bit of retail space for Fantasy Flight games and, you know, Games Workshop and people they're kind of allied with. It's a place where you can come and just, they have a big game library. You can check out some of their games and play it. You can, they have special events. Like once a month, they're going to run a main event, which is like a mini con. You know, where like the first one they're doing is like a Terranoth event where they're going to be doing Rune Wars events, Runebound and Descent stuff. And they're going to have promos just like a normal con, but it's kind of on a smaller, more Fantasy Flight Games focused scale. And they have events when new games come out, you know, just like Rune Wars, that they'll teach you and they'll have, it's just like a convention atmosphere all the time.
Yeah.
And
actually, when they had their grand opening back last week, I think it was the 21st of February, they, had copies of the new game Horus Heresy and this another new game that they just announced called Battles of Westeros, which is a game based upon the Song of Fire and Ice series by George R.R. Martin. You know, they've released a couple of games, the Game of Thrones living card game and the Game of Thrones board game. This is going to be another game in the same style as Battle Lore, sort of a hex-based two-person war game. And they actually had copies of that and chose certain people to play them. And they would, like, you know, call them over into the corner, you know, do you want to play? And then they got to actually preview the game. So, I mean, if you're a Fantasy Flight fan and you live anywhere near Minnesota,
yeah,
that's a place to go to be able to find out about those new games and play stuff.
Yeah, they've got memberships, and they've even got terrain you can check out. You know, that was kind of an aside. That was the nice thing about going somewhere to play War Machine is they had all this terrain, and, you know,
yeah,
we built this cool thing. They've got it on a much larger scale. So if you go to their websites, you can see the pictures of it. The place just looks fantastic, mm-hmm. and heck, I might go up there sometime.
We should make like a 3-day weekend out of it sometime.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like an 8-hour drive from mm-hmm. here, but we could drive one day, play, and then come back on a
go
Sunday
to one of
something.
Their main events.
Absolutely. Oh, let's consider that. That might
Absolutely.
Be kind of fun.
So, John already mentioned the Battles of Westeros thing. I've heard it has the Battle Lore name, mm-hmm. but they've changed a lot.
It's weird because it's on the box itself. It says it's a Battle Lore game, which makes you think that it's based upon the Commands and Colors system that mm-hmm. Richard Borg designed for Battle Lore. But in a press release from Christian Peterson, the head of Fantasy Flight Games, he says that the rules are actually going to be quite a bit different, and that the Battle Lore name is sort of the name they want to use for war strategy sort of games, like in this sort of setting, you know, and sort of with this hex based board, but that the rules aren't going to be the same as Battle Lore. Matter of fact, he says they might be a little bit more complex, more in the vein of a typical Fantasy Flight game. And I just poking around on Board Game Geek, I did find out, and that one of our listeners, Mr. Michael Jordal, was one of the people that got chosen to play Battles for Westeros at the opening of the new thing there. So if you go and check out, look under Battles of Westeros on Board Game Geek and look under reviews, he actually has posted a review of the game based upon his initial play.
Oh, wow.
So it's real interesting to find out about that. So that's already on the list of things.
Can we crash at your place, Mike?
Yeah. Can we come up? So anyway, that's exciting news from Fantasy Flight, as always. I also have some exciting news regarding our local convention, our little tiny local convention, Gen Con.
Heard of it?
Yeah. Cody, why don't you tell them about that?
This is a big news for us here in Indianapolis. They've, the past year or two, they've really worked on expanding the Indianapolis Convention Center.
Yeah, still ongoing, right?
Still ongoing. I think they're just finishing up. Since we tore down the old, I almost said the Hoosier Dome, the old RCA Dome, we've kind of expanded the convention center because Indianapolis, just as a city, they want to be known as like the convention capital of the world because we draw, I think the biggest one we have is like the National FFA Convention,
yep.
the Future Farmers of America, and like firefighters conventions and, you know, the NFL combines here, the Major League Baseball winter meetings were here, et cetera, et cetera. That's how kind of Indianapolis has marketed itself. It's a medium-sized city and...
Right, plus we've also got like the Final Four for college basketball
right.
is here this year.
Mm-hmm.
All the like drum corps stuff is here every year and yep. National marching band stuff. So, yeah, we got a lot of stuff going on convention-wise.
Yeah. So with that, as they're finishing up the ICC, Gen Con has extended their contract through 2015...
Woohoo!
So, very good news.
Yeah.
I don't think they're leaving. I mean, I think they get a good deal here, and all the hotels and restaurants are just so close, because, I mean, it's a smallish city.
Yeah. And I think that the city has really embraced Gen Con mm-hmm. quite a bit, and a lot of, you know, restaurants, we mentioned the Ram a lot, you know, do stuff to kind of hype up the convention and to welcome in the participants. So, so we're excited because, you know, I don't think we're going anywhere.
And no.
So we'll be here to cover Gen Con for years to come. All righty. So that's gaming news. Yay, gaming news. Well, you know what? You know, we closed the game on Inbox, but we actually had a couple of emails more geared towards role-playing games.
Oh.
And so I think it's probably another a time for another episode of the GM Academy.
Let's do it. Love that music. It's just like
a state regal
masterpiece theater. We have a question from Anthony Salvaggio. I believe that's how you pronounce it. He had a couple questions on 4th edition D&D, and I've just kind of combined them here for your benefit. He asked what the minimum number of people necessary to play D&D 4th edition is. Can you play this with two people? Can you play it solitaire? And can younger children play 6 to 10 year old range if the adult in the group is a DM?
Educate us, Professor
Cody. I will. I'll take the third question first. What game show was that?
Oh, I don't know. But I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I was like, I'll take the third
part. Oh, that's 21, I think.
Okay.
I don't know. I'll take the third part first. Can you play D&D 4E Solitaire? You might say no, but you can. There are rules in the DMG about playing the game without a DM, to where you just have a bunch of people that want to play and no one wants to DM. And it basically evolves into you just flipping over the monster manual and fighting things equal to your level. And so...
So maybe the question more is, should you play in solitaire?
Yeah, right, and I would say no. You know, he asked, can you play with two people? What's the minimum number? I think a good group for at least 4th edition is 5. I think that's kind of your magic number. 4 to 6, you can also go with. My current group is 7, which I think is too big, but it just kind of got that way. 5 is your magic number. You can go with 4 or 6. Any more or less gets kind of hard to run. You can play with pretty much... Like, mathematically, you could play with any number of people, because once you get to the mechanics of the game, it's all kind of formula and mathematic-based. So mm-hmm. You could play with a group of 12, and the game would find a way to balance. It would just be a horrible slog. So, yeah, you can play it solitary. You can play it with two people using those alternate rules. I would say don't. I would say go a different route with it. He mentioned younger children, 6 to 10-year-old. I probably would steer them away from 4th edition. I would say maybe a different way to go would be to break out a game. You could do, I think Descent even by might be a bit much. You could do something like Talisman and kind of do a bit of a role-playing spin on it. Now, I know John kind of, you did this with your son when we would play Heroescape.
Right.
And, you know, I think if you can just kind of, you know, say you're playing Talisman. It's like, oh, I'm playing the wizard. It's like, what's the wizard's name? It's like, you know. Oh, he goes into he lands on the tavern space. It's like, oh, what does he do in the tavern? That's a good way to kind of get him into it without kind of overloading him with, you know, the core rules and the tough rules of D&D and stuff like that. It's like, just kind of sneak in kind of smaller games and add your role-playing here and there. And then as they get older, I would say probably about 12, 13, then you can really start kind of hitting them with the dedicated role-playing games. They'll have a good foundation of which to base that off of, you know?
It seems like if you play with really young kids, like I could probably do D&D with my son who's almost 7, but I'd have to do all the math. I mean, I'd have to do all the, you know, and I would have to do a lot more leading as far as, you know, he would say, I want to shoot that. You know, well, okay, you're behind a tree and you're, you know, all the details that are and granularity that are put into the D&D rules, I as the DM would have to figure out, because all he would want to do is shoot something. So it'd be almost better to pick maybe like a, we've talked about this before, like a cinematic sort of more role-playing focused RPG, right?
Right. Yeah, I would probably not do D&D or Pathfinder or any of that, you know, kind of do the more independent systems. You could do even something like Mouse Guard. Don't do all the rules that come with it, but the theme of that and the general thrust behind it, you could easily adapt to something with kids, you know. Just keep it simple, you know, adapt it to board games if necessary, but just kind of add it in a little at a time, and I think they'll be ready in a few years to really get into the heavy role-playing games.
Thank you, Professor Cody.
Well, no problem.
Well done.
Thanks.
Well done. Well, we'll close the doors to the GM Academy for this episode. And if you have any questions for Cody about role-playing games, whether you're a GM or a player or you're just new to that particular hobby, Cody would love to answer those questions. Yeah, so email him at thegameoninbox.
gameoninbox@gmail.com.
And that's true for any comments or questions that you might have. We love getting emails, and as you can see, we read quite a few of them because we feel like we are definitely not the authority and the smartest people in the gaming hobby.
No, definitely not.
far from it. We're just the ones that bought microphones. And so we would love to hear from you and to share your wisdom with our listeners. So that just about wraps up the Game On Inbox for this episode. Let's move on to the big deal, where we're going to talk about event games.
Let's do it.
The big deal.
As far as deals go, this one's pretty big.
Welcome to the big deal, where we're going to be talking about event games. This is sort of an extension of our discussion from last episode, where we were talking about game groups. And just the idea of getting folks together to play games got us thinking about event games. And also, the last couple weeks, we had a chance to try out Twilight Imperium 3rd mm-hmm. Edition and Rune Wars, which we'll be getting to in our By Triad and I segment in a minute. But that got us thinking about these big meaty games, you know, the ones that you buy and they just sit on your shelf for a long time because you know they're not going to be like Dominion where you get it to the table just about every game group. It's going to be something that you've got to prepare for.
And then the only games of it you ever play are learning games.
Yeah,
because you can never get the same group of people to play it twice, it seems.
Right, and that is a frustration of these kind of things. And you know, let's start off by talking about that because I'll go ahead and tell you, I own a. In this genre of big games, I own, you know, now I own Rune Wars. I own Twilight Imperium 3rd Edition. I own StarCraft, the board game. I have Descent. I know you're getting a theme here. These are all big Fantasy Flight games. In the past, I have owned D-Mocker. I own a copy of Diplomacy. These are the kind of games we're thinking of here.
Doom?
Doom might be considered that as well.
It's
yeah.
Descent in space.
Yeah, good point, yeah. So anything that takes like 3 or more hours to play, you know, a normal game of, we would consider to be an event game because you just can't, you know, like we said in the game on Inbox, Cody's friend Josh, you know, comes over to the game night at 7 o'clock. He's like, I can bring Twilight Imperium with me. That's just not going to work, no. You know? And so that is one of the frustrations of having these games in my collection is that I just don't get to play them very often. And getting them together and getting to the table just seems to be a real challenge. Do you have games like that in your collection? Or?
Yeah, there's a few. There's one that comes to mind. It's a Kinzer and Company game called The Great Space Race.
Okay.
And I like the idea behind it because it's a racing game with like a combat element to it. And I think that's cool, you know. But the game is like a 3-hour game. Yeah, and to me, I mean, not to get away from the theme too much, it's like, last night we had a game night, and I hadn't played it in a while. I'm like, oh, I'll bring out Great Space Race. And then I was kind of flipping through. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is like a 3-hour game.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, I kind of don't want to throw that on people. You know, I want people, if they're coming into like a long game like that, to know what they're getting themselves into.
Right.
Because if they come in and that's not their cup of tea to begin with, they're just going to be miserable for 3 to 4 hours because I'm going to be teaching, so it's going to be longer than that.
Right.
So that's the big one. You know, I've got a lot of the same ones you do. You know, I've got Descent. I've got games like that. That, you know, my big frustration is, I've said in the past, you know, I like learning new games. The learning game in and of itself is very tedious for me.
Right.
And it's just, I'm an impatient guy, you know, I just want to get to the game. But it's a necessary evil. But
right.
I just feel like it never, that second game never comes to where, okay, you know, now we're cooking. So
And that's, I think, a huge problem with, I mean, I'll use Twilight Imperium as a good example, as a epic space battle game that, you know, a first game of that could take upwards of 8 hours to play.
Yeah, if you play through a full game of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, go from start to finish, plus the setup and the learning and all that kind of stuff. And I think that after you get through that that experience of playing through that one big learning game, you're tired,
yeah.
You know, and maybe you had a good time playing it, but... you know, anything that I play for 8 hours straight, I'm not sure if I'm going to want to play again very soon, you know. But that's the kind of the problem, is that if you play through a Twilight Imperium and you had that learning game and it was tedious, and so you want to have a better game experience next time, that next time needs to happen soon. I mean, you can't wait 6 months to play it again because you will have forgotten all the rules and it becomes another learning game.
It's almost like you have to schedule it in pairs.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm going to teach you Descent this Sunday, and then in 2 weeks, we're going to play it again.
Right. Well, and I think that brings up even another point about the Road to Legend and Sea of Blood campaign versions of Descent, I think have really helped that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can say, we're going to play Descent, and then 2 weeks, we're going to play Descent. It won't be the same game. You know, you're continuing that campaign, but you're learning as you go. So, I think that's a real problem with these games. And I think there's also... not too many of them that are big and meaty like that are good enough to be able to kind of grab you in and want you to play that second game so soon. Because, you know, we played Twilight Imperium, and we liked the mechanics of it, but there's still a whole lot of it that I don't understand very well, or
yeah.
I don't know what my best strategy is. And I want to play it again, but I'm not like, it's not like number one on my list.
Right.
Oh my gosh, above all other things, I need to play this game, you know?
Yep.
You know, when you buy one of these games... how do you get it to the table? You know, what's the best method for getting it to the table?
Well, I think, at least from experience, you have to first identify who you think's going to enjoy it. You know, you don't want to invite people that like, you know, pretty much all light games to a big heavy thing. You know your audience, obviously. But I think you just have to set a date, and it's a lot like going back to the gaming groups where you can't waffle on a date, you can't do it by committee. You just have to say, okay, on February 12th we're doing this, and who's in, you know, mm-hmm. and you get who you get, and you'll eventually kind of find out if you have enough to play it, and then if you don't, you can scramble, obviously, but. You know, you set a date and a time, you know, you set it maybe a month in advance and say, okay, we're going to learn Descent. You know, I'm going to teach you guys Descent. And then if we like it, you know, maybe in a week or two, we're going to play it again just to kind of cement it. You have to plan it like, just like a party or like a special social function, you know, you have to keep that in mind. It's not just like, hey, we're going to get together. We might play Descent, whatever. You know, it's like how you would schedule any RPG, because RPGs are basically event games. That's something you said before we recorded, that's exactly right. You know, with RPGs, you say, hey, we're playing D&D on Friday. Everyone knows we're playing D&D. It's going to take 4 hours, blah.
You know? Can't show up expecting that either, A, it's going to be a short experience, or B, that you're not going to play that.
Right.
You know, you'll know ahead of time that that's what's being played. That's the purpose that you're there.
Yeah. So I guess the best thing to do is just take initiative and say, we're playing Descent, we're playing at this time, at this date, and let me know if you're coming.
Yeah. And I think that even going back before you even purchase the game, that's maybe another consideration is, you know, be careful when you purchase these games.
Mm-hmm.
I'm worse probably than most about seeing the new shiny.
The cautionary tale.
Yeah, I'm the cautionary tale. I see the new shiny thing and go, ooh, I'd love to get that. Really, the fact that I bought Rune Wars is...
That surprised me.
It surprised Cody, because we had all these discussions about, well, I've got TI3 that I've never gotten to the table. I've got StarCraft, which I still haven't gotten to the table. You know, maybe soon.
Yep.
And then I buy another game like this, you know. And the main reason why I bought Rune Wars is because I wanted to review it on the show, you know. And I thought that would be a good review for everybody out there. And it would be fun for us as well. But, you know, it was with... Was it a wise choice? Well,
I thought you were joking, but when you told me, hey, I bought Rune Wars, I'm like, yeah, sure you did.
Yeah, but I think before you make the decision to buy a game like that, even if you've read through the rules and everything and you think that it's going to be good, is really keep in mind, how often are you going to be able to play it? You know, is it Jones Theory compliant if you're a subscriber to the Jones Theory? And you know, how often are you going to get at the table? If you think it's going to be less than once a year, you know, it should really give you pause, you know. Yeah. And so when you get these games to the table, you know, you've set up your time that you're going to do it. There's probably some preparation steps that you can take that will help the game experience to be better. These are steps that we didn't really take for our recent big box games that we played, but that might be helpful to you. One, see if you can get a copy of the rules and give them to everybody to, you know, either download. They can a lot of websites now have the rules for download. If all of us had read the rules to Twilight Imperium ahead of time, that might have been helpful.
Maybe. I don't know. It's being on the receiving end of that, it's the lazy in me kind of wants to be like, oh, he'll just teach me. I don't need to flip through this.
Well, I know, but...
It's a good idea, I'm just saying.
In a world without so much laziness.
Yeah.
If people actually did read the rules, it would improve the experience, right?
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah.
I think another good thing is, if you can... set up the board and all the components ahead of time.
Yes.
Now, there's two schools of thought on it. I've seen where people have set up the board as they explain the rules and say, this is a command center. You do this with it. This, you know, as they set it up, which works. But I think when you walk in, you see everything set up. You see all chits and counters and everything just kind of sorted. I think it makes the teaching experience easier because you can just say, these chits are for health, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Versus, you know, as you're fumbling through kind of sorting your mind, you're like, those little hearts over there, yeah, put them on a pile, that's your health, yeah, we'll get that in a second, you know. I think it's as much front-end streamlining as you can do, I think the end result will be that much better.
Yep. One good example of where we did that was our Day of Diplomacy back in November of last year, where Cody had everything set up ahead of time. And when everyone walked in, he had all of the computer tools set up. He had all of the order sheets laid out. And it was really nice because, you know, you really felt like you came in ready to play. It wasn't you come into an empty table and you've got to spend half an hour to an hour setting everything up. Now, for games like TI3... and Rune Wars, to a certain extent, you know, you actually build the board cooperatively. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody contributes to building the board. So, but the more preparation that you can do ahead of time to get people engaged into the game, I think, is a good thing. Because if they're just sort of sitting around, I don't know. I just have found that if you have a big, long game like that, you got to keep people engaged, especially if they've never played it before. They aren't bought into it yet, you know? I mean, a game like Descent, I have enough friends that like Descent that if I say, come on over to my house and let's play, they will be engaged in that game and they'll be ready to go because they played it before and they know that what a good game it is. But for a game that they've never played before, you know, they might find themselves saying, oh, you know, instead of doing this, maybe we could just put this. I know you were joking, but I think you even said that a couple of times to your RTI3 game. Yeah, maybe we could play some Red Dragon Inn instead.
I got Flux Guys. That's funny.
it's a game. These kind of games require some commitment. You know, they require some folks that are able to pay attention and keep their attention focused for a longer period of time.
Now to go back to your game setup thing, you know, Rune Wars and TI3 kind of have a modular, the players build the board thing. Mm-hmm. I would say even for that first game, go ahead and build the board yourself. You know, make it balanced. You know, your idea of balance. Because my idea is, like when we did TI3, you pretty much build your section of the board, or you can put things in other people's paths or whatever. But at that point of the rules explanation, I don't know what any of these things do.
Hey, you don't even know why you're doing it.
Yeah, so it's kind of like, well, if this was just already set up, you know. I mean, be fair about it. Don't, you know, screw everyone and make your path really clear. But just do, I'd say almost treat it like a convention demo in a sort of way.
Oh, yeah.
You have the board set up. You have, you know, everything ready to go. And even for those modular games, you can even explain as the rules go on. You can say, now, when we play our full version of this, you can say when instead of if. When we play our full version of this, you'll be able to set the terrain the way you want. So as you play today, kind of get an idea of what strategies might be good if you're able to really master the terrain.
Oh, that's a good idea. So. I was even thinking about a game that's totally not a event game, Campaign Manager 2008, that we just reviewed. That's a game that has that card drafting mechanic, but they give you kind of a starter deck to play the first time. I think that's a really good idea for game designers to do that because you just don't know what you're doing when you start off.
Yeah. And go easy on the expansions unless you think they make the game better and faster for that first game.
Yeah, to Josh's credit, who taught us TI3, he used the Shattered Empires expansion, but a lot of that was because some of the improvements they made with those expansions, it didn't bloat the game, it just streamlined it.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. That's what I had in mind, you know. If you're teaching Descent, maybe just teach the base game. Don't teach three expansions worth in it, you know.
Right.
Yeah, just keep it real simple and real basic, and then once they get the main idea, tacking on the expansions is much easier.
Right. So there is that the learning curve part of it, and so I think one key an ingredient to doing an event game is having someone who knows the rules really, really well. For some games, like for Descent, for example, Cody and I pretty much know the rules to Descent cold, I would say. And so if we wanted to have a group of people over, it would be real easy to teach that game. Unfortunately, especially again going to Rune Wars, which we'll talk about in a minute, you know, that was a game where I had to read the rules ahead of time. None of us knew how to play when we sat down to play it, and so I had to sort of half teach the game from the rules. If you can avoid this, please try. Because I have very patient friends, and I also have Cody.
Hi.
and so, you know, when you are constantly having to go to the rule book, I think it gives your players just this sort of unsafe feeling. I don't know.
It lowers the confidence.
Yeah. They feel not confident that, you know, what you're doing, or that you're even telling them the right thing. And I hate that feeling as a game teacher when someone asks me, well, can I move this piece here? And I go, yeah, I think you can. And then I go look for the rule book and they're shaking their head like he has no idea what he's talking about, you know. And I think one of the things about games in general is that, and why people like games, one of the reasons why I like games is that everybody sits down, there is a common set of rules, and we all participate in them. You know, that we all are bought into the fact that, you know, I'm not going to move my piece here because the rules say I can't move my piece there. And it's those constraints within which we can carve out our victory that make gaming interesting, I think.
Yeah.
So I think that when you have a whole bunch of people that don't know the rules, then you have no one who knows the rules, then that makes it a really unpleasant experience. So know the rules, at least one person ahead of time. So to that end, with needing someone to learn the rules, would you say that is a convention a good place to learn, to have a learning game of an epic or event game like this?
I think it depends. I know John and I both learned Descent from conventions, from either demo games or special events. I think the big thing with us is that we played together not long after that.
Right.
And I think that's the key. It's like, I think you can you learn TI3 at a con? Sure. And the Fantasy Flight game people are probably very equipped and very used to teaching it, and I think they can do so in a quick way. But it's just like any other learning game, I think. If you don't play it again for 6 months, it doesn't matter.
Right.
And depending on the convention, it may be really noisy. Like if you're doing a big Fantasy Flight demo in the middle of the Gen Con Dealers Hall, if you can focus on that, then good. But some people will have a problem with the noise and just all the activity to really kind of focus in. But I think it's just as good as any. And you might get that kind of expert touch to it. It'll be a faster rules explanation just because they want to get people through the booth, but I think as long as you follow it up, and they'll want you to follow it up, because the idea is you'll play it, you'll like it, you'll buy it, you'll share it.
Right.
You know, if you can follow it up, then I think it's as good as any.
Well, you highlight what I think is just a dilemma with this kind of game is frequency of play. You know, you want to be able to play that game at the con and then play it right away, but it takes a lot of effort to put these kind of things together. I mean, you know, we talked about having our day of diplomacy for quite a while,
yeah.
And it really did take Cody just kind of saying, let's get it on the calendar, what day are we going to do it, you know, and we set the date, and once you kind of set the date, then, you know, you can sort of work towards that goal, but, you know, and then after we played it, we said, you know, we loved it, we loved diplomacy, we want to play this again really soon, you know, but now 4 or 5 months have passed, you know, we've moved on to some other stuff, we will play again, and we'll do, I think, at least a yearly game of diplomacy, but I think that's a struggle is, you play the big epic game, it was fun, but we all have lives where we have other stuff going on and other games to play and other parts of the hobby that we're even participating in, and it doesn't get to the table that often. Should that mean, is the question I'm getting to here, should there be a minimum number of event games that you should have in your collection, or a maximum number of event games? Jones Theory will help to, you know, sift out a lot of those, I guess.
Yeah.
But if you take Descent, TI3, Rune Wars, Diplomacy, I think those are all Jones Theory compliant.
I do too.
But is there another reason that maybe you should cull those from your collection?
Yeah. I mean, with that, I think once a year is too little to get. I don't think, you know, that's justifiable.
Mm-hmm.
I think you just have to look at frequency of play. I mean, perfect world, what I would do is just play meaty games twice a month, play one old game that you've already learned the rules to, and then learn one new one, which and then will become an old game as you go through the months.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, if you don't have that option, I think minimum should be twice a year, you know, once every 6 months. If it's not getting to the table once every 6 months, then you gotta pitch it. So, I don't know. I mean, you've got to look at your group, and you have to look at the people who will be playing, you know, to really decide if you want it. But I'll echo what John said. More so with other games, I think with these games, you really got to be careful before you pull the trigger.
On the buy.
Yeah. On the buy. Because, you know, it's real easy to get caught up. I've done it. John's done it. You know, most of you have probably done it. You see, oh, man, Descent looks awesome. And get it. When I first got Descent, that's what happened. You know, it's like...
Yeah, you've owned it twice now, right?
Yeah, I've owned it twice. And I got it just thinking, oh, yeah, you know, my group will love this, or, you know, whatever. And it didn't get the table for a long, long time. You know, I usually played with John and his copy. So, you know, just buyer beware on that. A lot of these are good, but I think these you really have got to do your homework and really have to decide if it's going to be good for your group.
Yeah, you almost have to be if you own it, you have to be the advocate for that game, I think.
Yep.
If you like Descent, then you have to be the one that's setting it up and calling people and saying, I'm playing Descent this weekend, who's coming over? You know,
you got to sell it. Oh, yeah.
You got to sell it, that, you know, and make people enjoy it. So, make them enjoy it, but make them at least,
have fun!
Make them at least buy into wanting to come over. Now, some other event games that we haven't really mentioned, you know, things like role-playing games, you know, that's just a natural event game. You know, there's a whole bunch of a whole different conversation about how to...
It pretty much has to be an event game.
Yeah, yeah. You can't just, you know,
hey, let's play D&D. Yeah, okay.
Although that's one of Cody's jokes. Every time we get together and have a game night or something, you know, we'll say, well, we've got about an hour. What do you want to do? And he's like, oh, D&D 4th edition, which is kind of funny. You're a funny guy.
Thanks.
But things like war games, Cody and I don't really play a whole lot of war games, but things like Advanced Squad Leader and some of those longer war games... they're They're also event games. A lot of those games are two-player games, and so that's a different sort of thing altogether. It might make it even a little bit easier. It's an event, but it's a two-player event. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a buddy and you've got a free day, then you know that can be pretty easy to put together an afternoon of that. One game that comes to mind for me is War of the Ring from Fantasy Flight, which is a not originally for Fantasy Flight, because we're not just talking only about Fantasy Flight games. You know, big epic sort of war game about the Lord of the Rings universe. That would be one that would probably take 3 or 4 hours to play, but with just two players.
Here's an old school one for you.
Go.
Kingmaker.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that bad boy?
I do. That's another one. What about Titan? Titan's a pretty long one, isn't it?
Yeah, that can be. That's the great father of Ameritrash games. Yeah, that one can take a while. That's a fun one, too.
Oh, you know, I guess one other point you could bring up is what's the line between just a long board game and an event game? You know, would you consider Battlestar Galactica an event game?
No.
No, but it's right on the line, because that game could take up to 3 hours to play, depending on how many people you have.
Yeah, if everyone knows it, though, that game goes pretty quick.
Right. So that's something also with games like these big event games, is that if you are good at them, if you really do get into a rhythm where everybody knows the rules, you can cut the time off of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Because we're going to talk about Rune Wars in a second. I think that game might take, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 hours to play the first time, but you could probably shave a couple hours off of that if everybody knows the rules.
You can probably play a 4-player game of it in 3 hours, I think, if everyone knows the rules.
So you might be able to turn an event game into just a longer game.
Maybe. I don't think the game length is everything. I think a lot of it is just kind of the depth of the rules.
Okay.
You know, so it's kind of like, there's a lot, you know, as we'll talk about, there's a lot going on. Even if the game goes quick, you know, relatively quick for its size, you know, it's still not one you just want to bring out. To me, for those kind of games like Descent and Rune Wars and stuff like that, I need to kind of get myself in the mental state for it, you know? It's like, right. If I'm just at a game night, oh yeah, we're playing light to medium length games. You bring out that, I've kind of like, okay, I got to focus. And it's not like that for everyone, but for me, I have to be in the mood to play one of those big, heavy games.
Yeah. One game that's not really a Fantasy Flight-ish, you know, fantasy giants epic game that's in this genre, I would think, would be the game Wealth of Nations by Table Star Games.
Yeah.
I think if you play that with a full complement of players, that could end up being an event game.
Yeah.
Because there's so much going on with that. That's one where, at Origins, they make a giant, like a giant board with three-dimensional pieces and everything for that game. So that, you know, that's another one that isn't in like the fantasy or space genre. That Demacher is a good example of one. It's a, you know, Euro game about German elections.
Where do I sign?
And that was one that I owned. I actually owned, and it never got to the table, and so I had to let it go.
I'm shocked.
Well, so that was one of those ones where I looked at it and I saw it as an opportunity, but I just wasn't going to be able to call up you or anybody else and say, I got this Euro game that takes about 5 hours to play. It's about German elections.
I'll try any game once, but with that one, man, you better have pizza and Coke waiting for me when I get there.
Exactly. Yeah, so that wasn't going to happen. So, the cautionary tale here is, you know, be real careful before you buy these games and have a plan.
Yeah. But I think there can really be a great reward. I mean, if you really get in that rhythm where you're tackling a media game a month and people start to get the rules to Descent, to Rune Wars, to TI3, what have you, I think then you can get into a really cool spot of gaming, which a lot of groups probably never get to.
Yeah.
And which I think would be a heck of a lot of fun to just be able to say, yeah, we play Descent regularly. You know, I mean, that's awesome. That would be really fun to do.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's all I've got to say about
about
the big event games. But, you know, we'd love to hear from you, the listeners. You know, if you have played some of these big event games, and we harped on about 3 or 4 Fantasy Flight ones, but any other ones that you've made whole days out of, we would love to hear about it. Tell us your stories and give us the pluses and the minuses, the ups and downs of playing these kind of gigantor games. And we would love to hear from you at the Game On Inbox.
At gameoninbox@gmail.com.
Yep. And, you know, say stuff that's more intelligent than what we are saying, because, you know, like I said, we just bought the microphones. So that about wraps up the big deal. We're going to move into our Buy, Try, or Deny. We're going to be talking about Rune Wars, a big epic game from Fantasy Flight.
Buy, Try, or Deny.
Game reviews for the common gamer.
It's that simple.
God, y'all. What is it good for?
Absolutely.
it's time for Buy, Try, or Deny, and you're going to notice a bit of a change starting with this Buy, Try, or Deny.
Yes.
We're kind of changing the way we do our review formats. It's not completely a radical change, but we've noticed we've gotten quite a bit of episodes under our belt now, and we kind of want to tweak our review system. And John, tell us a little more about idea here.
Here's the deal, is that we've done 38, 39 episodes now. We've done all these buy, try, or denies, and you know, we sometimes it's a buy, sometimes it's a deny. Overall, the bell curve, if we were to plot these, everything ends up being kind of some version of try, you know? I mean, unless we feel really strongly about a game that you shouldn't play it.
Understand.
Okay, there you go. And we don't, and you know, and games like that, if we both don't like it, we tend to not even review it on the show, you know, because we don't want to waste your time talking for 20 minutes about a game that we hate. You know, we the whole purpose of the reviews is to give you guys information to be able to go out and either try it or buy it if you're interested in it, you know. But we just sort of feel like just telling you what we think of it, just with a pure rating, isn't really that useful, you know.
Yeah.
And what we'd rather do is to give you a full review of the game, tell you what things we think are good about the game, which things are okay, and which things kind of suck. And from that, you can make your own decision, you know, because you know you're a better judge of what you like than we are.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. We're not going to give you a concrete buy or try or deny or try plus or buy minus or
right.
deny plus plus. You know, we're going to talk about the buy points, the try points, and the deny points that we would give. And then, like John said, you can make your own decision and see if it's for you. But I think you're going to get a pretty good idea of where we stand on a game just from that. We're not trying to shirk that and say, well, you decide. You know, we want to be helpful.
You'll be able to tell what we think of a game just by what we say coming up here. And like Cody mentioned there, what we're going to do is we're still going to call this our segment Buy, Try, or Deny. But mainly what we're going to be doing is, like he said, the things we really like, we're going to call those our buy points. And then we'll have some try points, the things we thought were okay. Then the deny points, because every game has something that's, most games have something that's bad about it. We'll call that our deny points. And from that, you can just sort of figure out on your own whether it's something that you want to purchase. So we'll see how it goes. It's just kind of a grand experiment here. If we do this for a couple episodes and you guys write in and say, this is terrible, and we turn off the recorder and say, that was terrible, then we'll probably go to something else. But we're going to try this for a little while, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, so
one thing we're not going to change is that John's going to give you the rules rundown of each game we do.
Sorry about that.
And for Rune Wars, here you go.
All right, so Rune Wars was released here in 2010 by Fantasy Flight Games. It was designed by Corey Konietzka and Christian T. Peterson, and it is for 2 to 4 players. I don't know what it's ages 10 and up, 14. I don't know. It's you know, you don't want to have a 5-year-old playing this game because it's way too complicated. But it is like we said in our big deal segment. It is a event game. I would say it's a big meaty board game. Takes a lot of time to play. I would say you want to carve out at least for your first game 4 to 5 yeah. to 6 hours.
Yep.
You know, now future games of that I think might take less maybe up to maybe 3 hours to play. But and if you're playing with only 2 players, then it might be even less time with that. But you want to allow yourself a lot of time to sort of absorb this game. So, you know, the game overview here from the rules is, in Rune Wars, 2 to 4 players control factions of fantasy armies in the land of Terranoth. Each player starts with control over his home realm and must spread his fledgling empire through the land, conquer territory, recruit heroes, and ultimately acquire enough dragon runes to dominate Terranoth and win the game.
They put out a really cool video hyping this game, Fantasy Flight did.
It's very cool, you'll
want to buy the game.
I will link to the video in the show notes because it's very, very neat. And you'll be able to visually see a lot of the things that I'm going to be just sort of talking about here. So as far as components go, there are a metric ton of things in this big box. This is a box that's the same size as Descent, Twilight Imperium, Tide of Iron, a lot of the just larger games that Fantasy Flight has put out. The game retails for $100 American, which is a lot, but you know, you get a lot in the box here. So you get a whole bunch of plastic units. The game is for 2 to 4 players, so each faction is going to have a whole bunch of miniatures for their units. These miniatures don't come on sprues, which is kind of cool. They're actually already bagged up in little plastic bags.
Kudos to FFG for that.
Yeah. In addition, you're also going to have a bag of miniatures for your neutral units. These are the monsters that you would typically see from the world of Terranoth. Now, Terranoth is used in the game Runebound and also in Descent. So these are the same kind of characters and geographical things that you would be familiar with from those games. So you're going to have the bag of neutral monsters, and they are little mini tiny versions of the monsters that you would see in Descent. Things like dragons and beastmen and razor wings and stuff like that. Then you're also going to have a bag of miniatures for your heroes. And these are the familiar heroes that you've seen from games like Descent. Things like Spirit Speaker Mach and Battle Mage Jace and our personal favorite, Sir Valadir.
The Wise.
The Wise with his big toothy smile. And so you're going to have that as well. So you have all those plastic units, and then you're going to have this board, which is a modular set of map tiles. And the tiles have some coordinates on them, so like 6A, 6B, 1A, 2A, that kind of a thing. Those are going to line up with some cards that we'll talk about in a second. But you'll have all these map tiles. There are four factions in this game, and they're all operate a little bit differently. There is the realm of men, which are called the Dakan Lords. So that's like the humans in the game. You have some elves in the game. You have, I guess, what you would call like demon chaos demons. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Wykar the Undead, which is the undead, you know, skeletons and necromancers and that kind of stuff. So all four of those operate a little bit differently. So you can select any one of those to play with. And they're each going to have a home realm. So the tile for their home realm is it's three hexes that are in sort of a triangle pattern. And those everybody will get one of those. But you're going to set up the board in a fashion that is going to sort of spread out the home realm so that none of them are too close to one another. It's an interesting sort of setup. You're going to start off by getting some quest cards. And those quest cards will have some coordinates on them. And you're going to each take the tiles that go along with those quests. And then you're going to take turns going around and building the board with those particular tiles. The reason why you want to do it this way is because you want the tiles on the board to match the quest cards that you have, you know, so that you don't draw a quest card that doesn't refer to anything that's on the board at all. So that's kind of a clever way of doing that. So your board setup is going to be different every time. Then after you set up those tiles, then your home realms are going to be added on to sort of the outside edge of the board. And that's where you're going to place your starting armies. Each one of the players is going to get a player mat. What would you call that?
It's more than a mat.
It's like a
dashboard.
I think the rules call it a faction sheet, but yeah, that's a good example. It's like a dashboard. And you may have played other games from Fantasy Flight that use this dial system where they put dials onto the board. Chaos in the Old World and Battlestar Galactica are two that come to mind. Well, each of these faction sheets is going to have three dials on it where you're going to dial up certain levels of resources that you have. There's three resources in the game: food, wood, and ore. And based upon where your dial is on those resources will help to determine what kind of stuff you can generate during certain points in the game. On there, you're also going to have some starting resources listed, and it's also going to have on the right side of the faction sheet a list of all of your troops that you'll have. Each faction has four different kinds of troops that are going to be on the game board that are represented by your miniatures, and so it'll have all the details of those for when you do your battles. So everybody gets a faction sheet, and you build your board, and you put your home realm in the right spot. Everybody is then going to build one stronghold. This is a little cardboard token that represents strongholds, and this is going to be where you're going to generate your armies from and can recruit troops. You'll start off with starting armies in those locations. The board pieces are very, very nice. They're colorful hexes, and there's an added feature that there's some mountain areas, and they come with these little sort of three-dimensional plastic mountain things that kind of rise up.
It's a lot like the Game of Life. Like the little mountains that you'd put on the board there.
Yeah, that's true. I hadn't even thought about it that way. But yeah, so you'll have those as well. And there's some rules for specific ways that you'll set up the board and what things can be touching other things. But you'll all kind of agree upon this board. You'll get your faction sheets. And then you'll get a bunch of other little tokens and things like that. But the main thing that's going to be important for you to have in your hand are your order cards. The game is driven by order cards. Much in the same way that a game like Puerto Rico or Twilight Imperium, you have those particular roll cards that are taken during the game, which will allow you to do certain things. Everybody is going to get 8 of these order cards. And that's sort of how your setup goes. You're going to each get a hero. So in addition to having your army, you're going to have a hero that's going to be, or multiple heroes perhaps, that are going to be walking around the board trying to complete quests. So you have armies that you're building up and you're going to go and fight stuff, and you've got heroes that are going to be questing around on the board. And what's the whole point of all of this? Well, the point is you're trying to acquire these dragon rune tokens. You're going to start out at the beginning with your home realm, which consists of 3 hexes, and there's going to be 3 of those dragon rune tokens in your home realm. 2 of those tokens, if you turn them over, will have a dragon rune on them. The 3rd one will be blank, and that's called a false rune. So everybody basically starts off with 2 true runes and 1 false rune. Over the course of the game, you're going to be doing things that will help you to acquire more runes. The runes are acquired via some of the quests will allow you, your hero, to acquire runes. And whenever you acquire a rune, you're actually going to take 2 of the rune tokens, 1 false one and 1 true rune, from off a pile off the side of the board. You're going to look at them, and then you're going to place them into friendly areas on the board. And so, you know, that way, as you're taking control of runes, they're going to be part of the hexes that are on the board, only 1 rune per hex. This will allow your enemy armies to maybe come in and try to take control of those hexes, which would then allow them to have control of that particular rune. The goal being that at the game would end if anybody controls 6 runes or 6 areas that have true runes in them. This is a quite a daunting task. Getting these runes is not a very easy thing, but that's what makes this kind of an epic game. So you can get the runes through these quests that your heroes are going to go on. And then you're also going to get them from controlling other areas. So you can actually march your army over into another home realm and take that over in order to control those runes. That can be kind of tricky, but that's one way that you can acquire those runes. Everybody is also going to get a secret objective card, which is some sort of condition that you can meet along the way. Like if you control a certain number of areas that have certain things in them, or if you, gain this specific amount of resource, then you can gain a dragon rune by turning in that objective card. So that's another way that you can get objectives or get dragon runes. So there's a lot going on in this game, and there's a lot of different paths to victory, but that is the main goal. And so after you've set up your map and you've gotten all your starting forces on the board and you've got your hero in the right place, you're going to be ready to play the game. Oh, let me go ahead and mention also, you're going to get 2 quest cards, and your hero will be going on quests, and they'll have 2 starting quests at the very beginning of the game. So playing the game is played in a series of seasons, and there are, 4 seasons, spring, summer, fall, and winter. And each round of the game starts off by playing a season card. There's 4 of decks, 1 for each season, and you'll start off the game by playing the spring card. The season cards have 2 things that happen on them. One is like kind of a primary ability, and you just read the text of the ability and you do what it says. Sometimes it's good things, sometimes it's bad things, but it's going to affect basically all the players. And then at the bottom of the card, you have a secondary ability, which is sort of the seasonal ability that will happen every time the season comes along. And it's kind of thematic in that way. So in the spring, you're basically starting over a new year. And so any of your troops that might have been routed, you flip them on their side when they're routed, then you would, stand them back up, and you get all of your order cards back. And it's just sort of the renewal part of the game. When you're in the summer, that's the time when your hero can go on quests. So that's the only time when questing stuff is going to happen. That's the secondary ability of that one. In the fall, you're going to be able to acquire some influence tokens or some cards that will, some things called tactics cards, which can give you certain special abilities. And that's when you're also going to shuffle up the fate deck. We'll talk about the fate deck in just a second. That's probably the most important deck of the cards in the game. And then in the winter, because it's the cold, dark winter, you're going to have a limit to the number of troops that you can have in any of your hexes. It's going to be limited by the amount of food that's on your food dial that's on your faction sheet. So if you had 8 troops in a particular hex, but then you only have 4 food, you actually have to destroy 4 of those troops because you don't have enough food to feed them. And so these are the main secondary abilities for these cards. So each round starts off with the resolution of a season card. And then you're going to choose your order cards. So I mentioned that everybody has 8 of these cards in their hand, and they're ranked in order 1 through 8. And then everyone will choose one of these cards and turn it up simultaneously. Then you're going to resolve each card in the order of that card, the priority of the card, 1 through 8. So the 1s would go first, then the 2s, and so forth. So you'll go in that order. And then you'll take the action that's on that card, do whatever it is you need to do on the board to resolve that action, then you'll move on to the next player. So after all four of those order cards have been resolved, then you will move on to the next season. Resolve the season card, then you'll choose another card. Now the first card that you played during the spring, that will stay down on the table, and so you won't be able to play that one until the next year comes around, because it's during the spring that you're able to gather up those order cards back into your hand. So any one season, you're going to play 4 of these cards and resolve 4 different orders. And that's kind of how the game is played. So it gives you a lot of variety, I think, and a lot of control over what you do. And you can choose what order you want to do things, and you get bonuses based upon, you know, what order you choose to do them in. I'm just going to probably go through the different orders that you can do. And then we'll do a quick overview of combat, and then I think that'll give you sort of a basic overview of how things go. Like I said, it's a big, long game, so that's why this review is maybe a slightly longer than our other ones. There's just so much more to talk about. So the first, the number one order card is a strategize order. And this is going to be an order that will allow you to move your troops from one hex to another. And it basically will allow you to move to either an empty area or a friendly area. One thing about this game is that you can only ever have one particular faction occupying a hex at any one time. And if it ever happens when you move into a hex where another faction is, then you're going to end up having a battle. So the strategize order is just for moving into friendly or empty locations. And you can move into an adjacent hex. You have a mobilize order and a conquer order. That's number 2 and number 3. Mobilize and conquer have the same basic ability where this is where you're going to be moving into areas and possibly battling with people. And the way this happens is very similar to Twilight Imperium 3 in that you have these activation tokens, and you'll basically choose a hex that you're going to activate, and then you're going to move all your troops into that hex from up to 2 hexes away. And there's rules of movement. You can't go through enemy territory and that kind of stuff. But basically, allows you to mobilize your forces and move into an area that you're going to want to take over. Now, the differences between the mobilize order and the conquer order are in what's called a supremacy bonus. Each one of these order cards is going to have a basic ability and then a supremacy bonus. And you get to activate that supremacy bonus if the card that you're looking at is the highest card that you've played this season. So it sort of rewards you for playing the lower ranked cards first and then moving upwards to allow you to do those supremacy bonuses. So if you played the number 8 card at the very beginning of the season, you could play the supremacy bonus on that card because that's the highest card you played. Any future card you play during that season is going to be a lower number, so therefore you wouldn't get to do the supremacy bonus for that particular card. So the differences in the mobilize and the conquer order have to do with your supremacy bonus. The supremacy bonus for the mobilize card allows you to resolve it twice. So you can mobilize forces once, then you can mobilize them again with supremacy bonus. The conquer order is going to give you a supremacy bonus that will give you benefits during battle. So if you're going into, for example, an opponent's stronghold, then you can cause that stronghold's defense to be lowered and, you know, kind of weaken your enemy forces. So those are those three orders. Those are the three main orders that are going to allow you to move troops and possibly start battles. The number 4 order card is a harvest order, and this is the sort of the resource management portion of the game. So each of the hexes that are on the board have a certain number of icons that represent those three resources I mentioned, food, ore, and wood. And so as you're conquering territory, you're going to gain more of these hexes, but you don't gain the resources from those hexes until you play Harvest Order. When you play that Harvest Order, then that will allow you to reset all of your dials based upon the territory that you currently control. So literally, you could go quite a bit of time during the game claiming hexes and, you know, claiming more territory on the board, but not actually reaping the benefits from those until you do the Harvest action. in the same way, if you happen to be losing territory and losing a bunch of resources, you still won't actually lose them until that harvest order resolves, in which case you would then lose those things. So why would you want to have particular amounts of resources? On the dials, you have a certain number. So, you know, like 1 through 8 or 1 through 10 for your food, for example. And then above each of those numbers, there's an icon for either a particular kind of troop or perhaps a tactics card or an influence token. These are sort of your resources during the game. And so when you start to resolve future orders like doing benefits from cities or recruiting troops, it's all going to be based upon these resources. And so you want them to be as high as possible because that'll give you the most, you know, troops and cards and influence and things like that for later in the game. So that's why you want to have those. Also, when you get to that winter phase, you want to have as much food as possible so you don't end up having to kill off your troops. So that's your harvest order. Then you also have what's called a recruit order. That's number 5. And that will allow you to recruit troops into one of your strongholds based upon one of your resources. So like I said, if you have a food resource of 4, then as you look above it, you're going to look at number 4 and all of the numbers that are less than that, 3, 2, 1, and 0, and look at above those numbers and see what kind of troops you have. Maybe there's a picture of 3 skeletal archers or something. Well, then you'll be able to recruit that number of skeletal archers into your stronghold. So as your resources go up, you might be able to recruit additional troops. As they go down, you'd be able to recruit less. So that's how you recruit troops. They always have to be recruited into one of your strongholds. And so then you have a recruit order. Then you have what's called a rally support order. On some of the hexes on the board, there are cities. These are hex tokens that are placed over top of the main hexes. And each of those cities will provide resources. They might provide tactics cards or influence tokens, or you might be able to get some additional quest cards for your hero. And so if you control a hex that has a city, then when you play that rally support order, then you'll be able to gain benefits from those cities. There's an acquire power order. The acquiring power order will allow you to gain influence. These influence tokens are used in various portions of the game, but they're a currency that you definitely want to have. I probably won't get into all the details of what influence does, but they'll allow you to possibly tip the balance in certain areas of the game with your opponents. So you'd like to have as many of those as you can. And then the number 8 card is called the Fortify Order, and that's going to allow you to repair strongholds, build strongholds, and this will also allow you to move rune tokens around. So if you have those false runes and those true runes, you can kind of move those around if you look like something might be threatened. So those are the 8 orders. Lots of options there and lots of things to do. And the order that you play them is important because of those supremacy bonuses. I didn't get into all of those, but so you're going to choose one of those cards and resolve it, and then you're going to do that 4 times: spring, summer, fall, and winter. And then it'll turn over and you'll do another year. So that is the basics of Rune Wars. You're also, just to mention real quickly, the questing phase of your summer card. That's the secondary ability is to be able to quest. So that's when your heroes can go and do questing things. Your hero can, on a questing turn, can either heal if they happen to have gotten damaged or something. They can train, which would allow their abilities on their little hero cards to get higher. Or they can actually go on a quest where they can move through hexes. And if they get to a hex that matches their quest card, then they can do what it says on that card to be able to resolve that quest. You know, sometimes those quests will give them weapons and things like that as rewards. And sometimes they'll get dragon runes as rewards. So the heroes, they kind of operate independently from your troops, although they can do things that are almost kind of a scouting maneuver, because if they go into an enemy territory that has a rune in it, it can allow you to peek at that rune to see if it's a true one or a false one. So they can help you in that way. So that's one part of the game that's a little bit interesting. And then the last thing I just want to talk about real quick is the battle part of the game, which is, I think, pretty clever the way that they've done this. And a lot of this is resolved by what's called a deck of fate cards. This game has no dice in it. 0 dice.
I know.
But it's still pretty good, though. And instead, it has a deck of 30 fate cards. And when you go into battle, If you, let's say you've done a mobilize order and you've activated an enemy's hex and you've moved your troops into that hex, well, now you're going to have to resolve a battle with that enemy. What happens is all of the troops in that hex are going to come off the board. You'll actually have a battle token that will go in that place, which will represent that a battle's going on. Then each player will take their troops and will place them on their faction sheet, onto the spaces where their different troops are described. Now, these troops are listed in a particular order, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. And that's actually the initiative number of that particular troop. And so you're just going to resolve five rounds of combat in each battle. So you'll start off with the initiative 1 things, and each player will say, well, how many troops do you have in your initiative 1? Then each player is going to draw that number of fate cards. The fate cards are kind of complex to look at, I guess, when you first see them. They're divided up into quadrants, and each quadrant is based upon a particular kind of troop. The troops in this game have different shaped bases. There's triangles, rectangles, circles, and hexagons. And based upon what kind of troop you're using, you're going to look at that quadrant of the card. And so you're going to have 3 possible options, well, I guess 4 possible options on each quadrant of this card. It could be blank, in which case nothing would happen. It's basically a miss. You could have some sort of a damage token saying that you inflict some amount of damage with that troop. You could have a special ability icon, which is kind of like a crystal ball, in which case that troop will resolve whatever special ability is on their faction sheet. You'll do that many number of times based upon how many special symbols that you have. And then you might also have a rout symbol, which will cause an opponent's troop to rout, or basically will lay down and will not participate in the battle anymore. So you'll resolve it kind of in this order. You'll resolve special abilities, then routes, and then damage. And so you'll have 1 card per troop in that initiative level. You'll resolve all those things. And it's kind of simultaneous. So even if you deal damage to a troop, of your opponent's troop, that troop will still be able to use their card to damage you, or do whatever it does. So you'll do that for the level 1s, then 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Now, or 2, 3, 4, and 5. Now, it might be that you have an initiative 2 creature, but your opponent doesn't. Well, in which case, you will just draw the cards and resolve them on your own, and your opponent won't really have any recourse for that particular round. You resolve all 5 of those rounds. Then you're going to kind of count up the strength of your army that's still standing up. And whoever has the most strength will get to claim the hex, and the other enemy or the other opponent will have to retreat. And if they're not able to retreat, they have to destroy their army. So that's it's a pretty cool resolution of battle. The fate deck is interesting. It's very different from dice, when we actually sleeved the cards for our fate deck right away, because we knew that would be a deck that's passed around a lot and is handled quite a bit. So that is the basics of Rune Wars. A lot there. I know it's a long explanation. There's a lot going on. The game will play until someone controls 6 rune tokens, or it'll go for 6 years. And at the end of the 6 years, you'll turn over all the tokens, and whoever controls the most will win. So that is Rune Wars, basically.
Basically.
I've even left out quite a bit there, but I hope that gives you kind of a detailed flavor for the game so you can sort of see what's going on. So, Cody, let's go ahead and start off with what we're calling... Well, do you want to start with what we call our buy points, or do you want to start with the deny points? Do we want to end on a happy or end on the sad?
I think we put our best foot forward. So let's start. Let's go buy, try, deny.
Sounds good. Okay. So, Cody, for you, what were your buy points for this game? What did you really like about it?
Well, what's nice is it's funny. We played TI3 just a few days really before we played this, mm-hmm. and with Rune Wars, it was nice because I got that feel from TI3. But it was more distilled. It seemed refined and focused in Rune Wars. You'd mentioned earlier in the big deal about everything being Jones Theory compliant. I don't know if this and TI3 would really get along that well.
Oh yeah,
Jones Theory wise, but not to get into that. But I felt like I got that experience, but I got it faster and better with Rune Wars, and I really liked that.
Okay.
Some of the other things I liked the broad range of game styles, and you kind of touched on that when you were giving the rules rundown, is like there's lots of little little things from each game. You have the orders that you do, which is a Puerto Rico TI3 kind of mechanic, which is a good mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
You have, a card-based combat system. You have, you kind of get a miniatures war game fix because you're moving a lot of plastic across the board. You know, it's got an area control aspect to it. You're moving heroes around, completing quests. There's a lot going on, but you feel it's a nice sampling instead of just a lot of stuff just mashed together. You feel like a lot of it feels fresh, and you're like, oh, this is nice, you know. I mean, the components obviously are Fantasy Flight Games quality. You got the great art, great components. It's top of the line. It's what they usually do, and this is no exception. This is a lot of good stuff going on there. And the fact that it's playable with two players, that's a big event, epic-type game with two players, is huge.
Yeah.
You know, I've got a wife that thankfully is willing to play with me sometime if I were to buy this for myself. So it's like, we could bust this out on a Saturday.
Nothing else to do, just play some Rune Wars.
So those are my buy points for it. What do you have?
All right, well, real similar, I guess. I think the game is very complex. There's a whole lot going on. But I find that it's very easy to grasp, to retain, and then later to teach. I'm the primary game teacher among my group of friends, but I'm really bad at reading rule books. It's kind of funny. I love to teach. I'm really bad, though, at reading and retaining stuff. And I found that this was a pretty easy rule book to read. And I also found that having played this game only once, here I've given you the rules rundown and, you can vote whether you think it was coherent or not. But but I was able to remember and tell you guys about all these rules very easily. Because I was able to grasp it that much. And I really felt like as we played the game, everybody who was playing, no one was just sitting there going, I have no idea what I'm doing or I don't have a plan. It was enough that even on a first play, even during that learning game, I felt like people weren't just moving plastic around for no reason.
Right.
You're able to formulate some kind of a plan early on. And so I think that's a really big selling point because it makes you want to play again, because you don't feel stupid when you're playing it. I think the interplay between the armies and the heroes is really well done because it's two sort of separate game ideas here that you're conquering stuff with your troops. And then you've also got these heroes that are questing around doing other stuff. And the heroes don't really help you in battle. I mean, if you have a hero in your hex when you're doing a battle, that hero doesn't really fight, I don't think, unless I've missed a rule somewhere. Just sort of a separate deal where your heroes are doing other things. But I like that because it's two separate paths to victory, and they can be going on at the same time. Maybe you have two quest cards where your hero is really far away from those quests. It's going to take 2 years, basically, for your hero to get over there where the quest is going on. So you're not gaining any dragon runes that way. So while you're waiting for that to happen, you're going to be taking all your troops and trying to move them over and trying to conquer your opponent's home realm so you can get those runes. So the interplay with that I thought was really, really cool because you always felt like you had something important to do. I'll echo what Cody says. The components are just beautiful. It's just, Fantasy Flight at this point, have they made a game in the last 5 years that isn't just beautiful?
No.
None that I can think of. No. So it just, when you say Fantasy Flight components, you guys who have played games like from them, you should know what that
means. It speaks for itself pretty much.
It does. And I also think that the combat system is very clever. I think the initiative for the units and kind of pulling everything off the board and then being able to go one round at a time makes sense to me, things, because you would have characters and creatures that would be faster than others, and being able to have them act first, I think makes sense. So, and I'd never seen really anything like that before, so I thought that was pretty cool. So moving on to try points. So those are all the things we loved. Here are some try points, some things that we thought were okay.
Yeah, one of my try points is actually the completely card-based resolution system.
Okay.
Now, I kind of warm to it, we make the Ameritrash dice jokes, but in the end, I think it worked well. I've read some things on Board Game Geek, and I really think that some people will say, oh, you should just use dice. I could see where some people be like, oh, it's a little fiddly, it's not for me. It's nice because the fate cards do so much. They're not just used for combat, they're used for so many different things.
That's a good point. I didn't even touch on that there's other icons on the cards mm-hmm. that are used to resolve quests and other kinds of things, too. So they're multi-purpose.
Yeah. I could see some people, it just wouldn't work for them. It's a try, definitely. Okay. For me, the little plastic mountains, they look really cool.
They're kind of useless.
Not sure how necessary they are. I mean, it's... you know, it's like you can't pass over a mountain unless you have flying. But there's also red lines on the hex that show you that. And the hex-based terrain itself, some people will like a modular board. Some people really won't. You know, some people just want a set board. And I could see that being a point of contention. And like I said, the mountains, you know, how much did that add to the cost and how much is it really necessary? It looks really cool, but yeah.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's really that necessary for the game.
I heard some people say that the like on Board Game Geek that if you don't know a little bit about how the game should go, like when you do your first game, it's possible you could totally set the board up in a way where it's just funky and it's like kind of the wrong shape and mm-hmm. it's like really elongated rather than being more you know, just kind of circular. So I can see how that could be a problem. Yeah. But maybe they could have benefited from having some kind of a standard setup for a first game.
Yeah. Which I think they should have. And my final try point is actually, you mentioned the heroes. That's a try point for me because I thought it's kind of disjointed. You know, you have your base army and then you have these kind of like rogue agents that are the heroes going around doing their own thing. And how they move and how they act is so separated from the rest that I don't think it's bad. You know, it's just kind of another layer. And I think the element is good, but it's just so disjointed from where your main strategy focus is. I think some people could be turned off by that, saying, well, why can't the hero just be like a general and less like kind of this vigilante going out and doing stuff?
Yeah.
So those are my try points. What do you got?
Okay. Well, I kind of think sort of similar to what you were saying, the fate cards, while they're very cool that they're multi-purpose, I think they're just a little bit fiddly though, mm-hmm. You're constantly having to pass this deck of cards around. I sort of found that at our table, we played a four-player game on a pretty big 5-foot diameter circular table, which was great. It was perfect size for the game. But I just sort of felt like there was never a good place to put the discard pile.
Yeah.
Because you don't shuffle the discard pile back up until that fall season. And I just, you kind of have to hand a deck of cards over. And it just felt very fiddly. It felt way more fiddly than just handing over a pile of dice. But you know, I see that it's very useful and it's a good way of doing it. You know, otherwise you would have had three or four separate decks of cards. But I just thought it was a little bit fiddly. And I think that the game rewards good strategy, but not quite as much as a Euro game. And I'm calling this a try point because this just sort of depends on what your bent is as far as games go. If you're someone who wants a pure strategy game where, you know, like Puerto Rico, I would say, or, you know, where, or Power Grid's sort of an example of that, where, you know, the game is based solely on what you do and on your strategy. And if you have a better strategy than your opponent, then you will win the game. You know, this is not that game.
Thankfully.
Yeah. Well, and if you're someone who leans more in a sort of an American style game direction with a lot more randomness, you might like this better because, there are some aspects to the game where you feel like you don't have a whole lot of control over what's going on. And if you get, like, those objective cards are a good example to me. Everybody gets one objective card, and if you complete the objective, then you get a rune, a dragon rune. But some of those objectives are just, I mean, you never really get them done, you know? I mean, and so you might feel like, you know, you get kind of screwed out of a dragon rune because you can't get yours done and someone else had an easier one or whatever. So there's a lot more randomness, I think, in the game. I personally like that, and that makes the game more fun for me. But if you're someone who loves pure strategy, then that might be give you pause for this one.
Yep.
All right, so now time for the bottom of the barrel. Do you have any deny points for this game?
Just a few, and they're nitpicky at best. I think John may touch on this as well. The box is... It does not need to be as big as it is.
I'll just say it right now with you. I mean, the box size is stupid. I don't think there's any reason why it needed to be in a box this size. There's one piece of the terrain that would be too long to fit into a normal square Fantasy Flight box. Other than that, everything can fit in a square box.
I mean, there's going to be an expansion coming out soon. You can, you know, here in the next 6 months, I bet.
Sure.
But, you know, I think they wanted to market it so well. I don't think the game gets as much attention if it's in the smaller box.
Oh, you're
right. It sounds silly, but you know, it's true. You know, you say, oh, this is the next big box game from Fantasy Flight.
They wanted it to feel epic, so they put it in the epic size box.
Right. Yeah, it definitely does not need to be in it. And then the high price point is it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's something to really give concern to. You know, it retails for $100. I've seen $115 at some places.
Uh-huh.
So I mean, you've got to, as we cautioned in the big deal, you've got to make sure, because this game is a high price point. And I know $80 is the new $100, or $100
is the new $80. Yeah.
This doesn't feel like a $100 game to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like more $80 game. But I don't know. That could just me.
Yeah.
What are your deny points?
That was pretty much it. The box size is about the only thing that I thought was a deny point. And it's just a nitpicky thing. Mm-hmm. You know, because after taking out the, I took out the box insert because there was no reason for it to be in there. And after I put everything back in there, I could probably fit that game in there three times.
Oh, my
goodness. And it would still fit. So, but that's about all that I have. So, right. I mean, really.
Some closing comments here?
Yeah, I know we said we're not going to give it a rating, which is fine. But, I mean, I really like this game a lot. I mean, I do not regret having bought it at all. It's, it's one that it's maybe, it may be, other than Descent, the first epic board game that I've ever played that I think I'm going to be able to get it to the table a lot. I feel like I can teach it easily, and I feel like people will be interested in playing it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I thought it was going to be just kind of a product of the hype machine. I thought we were going to play it. It was going to be a bloated, just overwrought, just, you know, TI3 with swords. You know, this is going to be this big bloated thing. I feel like at the end, I got the experience of playing a big, epic game, but it's one I can realistically play more than once a year. And I'm excited about that. You know, it's like I feel that, you know, after playing this, it's kind of like, wow, you know, that was a great game. You know, you could rack this up in a few weeks and do it again.
Yeah,
you know, and it has enough variety with the modular board and with the different factions where you can get a lot of play out of this, and I think really get a lot of satisfaction. This exceeded my expectations completely. It's one, even though you own it, it's one that I would even consider picking up down the road.
Yeah, and the fact that you said it was playable for two, and that you know, you can pull it out with your wife, and I'm not sure. I don't think my wife would play this one. I think it would just be too long for her. But yeah, that's another big selling point of the game. So I think you and I should get to this to the table within the next couple weeks.
Soon, absolutely. Yeah.
So that is Rune Wars.
Yep, that's the new segment. Hope you guys liked it.
Yeah, I hope you liked the way we did that. And if, you know, we'd love to hear your feedback about the review segment or maybe specifically about this game. So as always, we would implore you to write us at the Game On Inbox.
That's gameoninbox@gmail.com.
And tell us all about it. So there's Rune Wars. Are you ready to close out the show?
Let's do it.
All right.
As always, we thank you for listening to Game On with Cody and John. You are the reason we do it, listeners, so we appreciate it.
Thank you.
There are a number of ways that you can get in contact with us. We mentioned the Game On Inbox already. You can also go to our website at gameonpodcast.com. There you can subscribe and get alerted of all the new podcasts and any other reviews or any other special things we'll throw up on the site.
We'll throw up on the site.
We do have a guild on the BoardGameGeek.com website. We're Guild 576.
Yep, and we're also a proud member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. A lot of other great shows there, like The D6 Generation, Fear the Boot, The Game's a Thing, lots of other ones at pulpgamer.com.
Okay. We are on Facebook. We have a fan group there, so if you search Game On with Cody and John, become a fan with us there, and
and we should start to fire up some more discussion and stuff on the Facebook page there. We have so many different presences on the interwebs there.
And finally, we do have a donation button on our website. If you'd like to give back to the show, 100% of everything you donate does go back to the show and to you.
That's right.
Just to help us curb costs, we'd appreciate it.
Yep. So join us in 2 weeks where we're going to be kind of dialing down the meatiness on the games there, and we're going to pick up something that's a little bit lighter. A new game called Tobago or Tobago.
I think it's Tobago, like Trinidad and Tobago.
Is it Tobago? Okay.
I'm probably completely wrong.
Interesting little deduction game, and we'll give you our brand new Buy, Try, or Deny review for that one. And also be talking about lots of other great stuff, maybe some Hoosier Con stuff and lots of other great stuff.
USA versus Canada hockey tonight.
Oh, that's right.
Go USA.
So, you know, go and check that out, which will have already happened by the time you...
Sorry, I'm just real excited. I'm kind of discovering this hockey thing.
So. Oh, exciting, yeah. Well, all right. Well, that's it for Game On this time. And until next time...
USA!
And Game On.